Today's anniversary, we want to acknowledge that. Today is March 24th, 2009. It is now about 6 minutes after nine. And are we ready with electronic devices? Okay, Sue, and you're good to go too as well? Okay, thank you. Allow the record to reflect that Senator Myers, Senator French, Senator Kukash, and Senator Menard are present. I'd also at this time like to introduce my committee aide, Deborah Prater. Today we'll hear the following bills. I know for sure we're going to hear three. We might hear four. We'll see how time permits us to do that. Senate Bill 23 is the repeal of defined contribution retirement plans. Senate Bill 129, residential sprinkler systems. House Joint Resolution 19, oil tanker escort vessels, oil. And Senate Bill 126, reemployment of retirees exempt service. We'll begin with Senate Bill 23, and that's the repeal of defined contribution retirement plan. Senator Passavant is now carrying the bill. I appreciate you. Is Senator Passavant here? Or okay, he's not here, but we do have someone on. Her name is Beth Almeida, and she's going to give testimony. This is going to be like about a 20-minute PowerPoint presentation, so I'm going to have to limit other testimony to maybe like 60 seconds here. We'll see how this all plays out, and if I don't get through it all, we'll hold the bill till Thursday. Okay. Are you online?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Okay. Then we'll go ahead and start with your PowerPoint. And I'm going to go sit over here by Senator Kukash.
They gave me two packets of her. She's supposed to be on.
I haven't had someone run PowerPoint from off-net, so this is a new experience for me. So I'm sure it's just going to work like magic.
We hope so.
Okay. Senator Passavant has joined us. Would the record?
Okay. You might want to move to the French chair over there because we're going to do a PowerPoint right now.
Okay, good.
I'll let her grab this. Otherwise it'll be.
Okay, Beth, please begin.
Very good. Thank you very much, Senator Menard and the rest of the committee members for the invitation to appear before you this morning. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning about a couple of recent research reports that our institute has released, and we hope that you'll find the information in these reports useful. I'll try to pause throughout the presentation. I know that sometimes the phone, there can be a little bit of a delay on the phone, so that should you have any questions or need any clarifying information, I'll just try to pause periodically.
Okay, and then if you can just pick it up as quickly as possible, because there have been a number of the senators here that has seen this PowerPoint already, so just as quickly as you can go through it, it would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, very good, Senator. Just a few words about our organization. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization headquartered in the nation's capital. Our mission is to contribute to informed policymaking by fostering a deep understanding of the importance of retirement security, not just to employees and retirees naturally, but also employers and the economy as a whole. And the way we try to accomplish that mission is through research, education, and outreach programs that are national in scope. In terms of our membership, we do have a diverse membership of organizations interested in retirement security that include employee benefit plans, state and local agencies that manage retirement plans, trade associations, financial service firms, other retirement providers in both the public and private sector. I'm very pleased to run quickly through the findings of our recent Pensionomics report, and I'll just try to hit the highlights as per your suggestion, Senator Menard.
Thank you.
why we did this study. Well, we wanted to measure the economic footprint of state and local pension plans nationally and also within states. We know that defined benefit plans can act as an automatic stabilizer for the economy by providing reliable, predictable benefits that retirees can budget around. And so we wanted to, in this study, get a sense of how much of a stabilizing effect state and local pension benefits might have for the United States economy, and also within individual state economies. So what did we find? Well, using 2006 data, which was the most recent that we had available, we found that expenditures made out of state and local retirement benefits supported about 2.5 million jobs at the national level, paying about $92 billion in income. The total economic impact was about $358 billion nationwide, and about $57 billion in state, local, and federal tax revenue was supported by these expenditures. In terms of our what we found for Alaska, we found that within the state of Alaska, local retirement benefits supported more than 6,000 jobs statewide that paid about $358 million in income to other Alaskans. That's not including the value of the pension payments themselves, of course. The total economic impact statewide was about $1 billion, and about $155 million in federal, state, and local tax revenue was supported within the state of Alaska because of these pension payments. In terms of translating those into sort of a per dollar basis, we found that for every dollar paid out in benefits, but $1.25 in total economic activity was supported in the state. Mm-hmm. And for every dollar contributed by taxpayers, about $6.35 in economic activity was supported in Alaska. And again, that really speaks to the fact that taxpayer contributions are only one source of system financing. Of course, employee contributions and investment earnings on contributions making up the remainder of system financing.
Madam Chair?
Yes, and Senator French.
Can I jump in with a question?
Yes.
Okay, Beth, we're going to have a question here.
Hi, good morning. It's Hollis French, and I'm on your slide number 9, the one you just discussed, and I just want to jump in and ask a question. In Alaska, when you say the word taxpayer, that sometimes is a little confusing to us because it's not exactly clear what you mean. Do you mean the people that contribute to their own pensions, that is the deductions from my paycheck and other state employees' paycheck, to the pensions?
No, I'm sorry. We should be more clear with our terminology. When we're referring to taxpayer contributions, those are really the employer contributions. Of course, naturally, state employees are also taxpayers. However, the contributions that state employees would make to the pension system, we would characterize those as employee contributions. And in our study, we use terminology referring to sort of the employer share of the pension contribution. We call those taxpayer contributions.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. And I understand that there's further explanation a few slides ahead. Thanks.
In terms of the baseline data that we were working off, again, this was from the U.S. Census Bureau. What we find using their data is that close to 35,000 Alaskans received pension benefits from state and local plans in 2006. Total benefits paid out received by retirees were about $819 million. And the average pension was fairly modest. It was a little under $2,000 a month, or a little bit under roughly $23,000 per year. In terms of the financing, and I think Senator French just might be helpful in clarifying, offering additional clarification. What we find is that when we look over a period of 13 years, this was the entirety of the data available to us from this one data series. From 1993 to 2006, what we find is that employee contributions comprised about 12.5% of total system revenues. Employer contributions, or what I referred to earlier as taxpayer contributions, comprised about just under 18%, and the remainder, almost 70%, was made up of investment earnings. When we talk about the economic impact of state and local retirement benefits, we can kind of refer to what economists call a multiplier effect. And what we mean by this is that the very kind of basic process that goes on, whereby in an economy, one person's spending becomes another person's income. And when that occurs, the person who's on the receiving end of a payment, in other words, when they're receiving income, they then have additional purchasing power to go out and make additional purchases. So there's this rippling effect or a multiplier effect, which has the ultimate effect of making any initial event in an economy, in our case, we looked at the initial event being the expenditure of pension payments by retirees, has a much bigger economic impact once you take into account all of these ripple effects. And that's really quantitatively what we did in this study. So we used publicly available data from government sources, and I can later in the Q&A talk in more detail about the methodology should folks have technical questions about that. And using that data, we then used an economic input-output software modeling called IMPLAN. IMPLAN is a very widely used economic impact input-output software model, which analyzes how various sectors of the economy interact with each other. And what it allows us to do is measure along various yardsticks or in various ways the ultimate economic impact of an initial event in the economy. And so again, in this case, that initial event was the expenditure when retirees go out and spend their pension check. And in terms of the economic impacts we were looking at, we looked at jobs, we looked at incomes generated, we looked at tax revenues and total economic impact. So again, just to recap some of these findings, we found that there was a total economic impact of about $1 billion within the state of Alaska attributable to state and local pension payments, about $155 million in tax revenue impact, and this slide 16, breaks that down in terms of federal, state and local, and other taxes. In terms of the industry analysis, we did also we also wanted to drill down and see sort of sector by sector what the economic impacts looked like within the state economy. And what we found was that there was a pretty deep and wide economic footprint in virtually every industry in the state. The industries that had the greatest economic impact were healthcare, which is probably not very surprising given the population that we're talking about and the expenditure patterns among elderly households, retail trade, and accommodation and food services. Slide 18 provides a detailed breakdown by industry, and we can talk in more detail about that should the committee members so desire. Getting to into these pension multipliers that I presented before. Again, here the idea is, what is the total economic impact of each expenditure, each dollar in expenditure made in the local economy? And this really indicates to us, for each dollar that's spent, what is the ultimate ripple effect or that multiplier effect? And again, we calculated for the state of Alaska that a dollar paid out in pension benefits to retirees in Alaska translates into about $1.25 in total economic activity within the state. We also wanted to calculate another multiplier, if you will, to kind of get a sense of what the return, if you will, is on contributions made by taxpayers or public employers to state and local pension plans. And again, because we have employees making contributions, and we have investment earnings, because these systems are pre-funded, doing a lot of work of financing these benefits, we find that this multiplier is really quite large. So a dollar contributed by Alaska taxpayers, or those employer contributions, turn into about $6.35 in total economic activity within the state. So what did we conclude from this analysis? Well, we concluded that state and local pensions have a large economic footprint, not just nationally, but also within each of the 50 states, including Alaska. And this measuring this ripple effect, really is significant, because that spending really does multiply and reverberate through the economy. It's very well known and generally recognized, that I think, that pension plans are important for the people who get those pension benefits. But it's often not as well recognized that other folks in the community benefit as well when members of the community, older households, have that sort of predictable amount of income that they can make their regular expenditures out of. You know, whether that's going to the pharmacy, going to the local hardware store, going to the local doctor. And again, this sort of automatic stabilizing effect that that the particular kind of pension that that state and local benefit, excuse me, state and local employees have, a defined benefit pension plan, is very critical, especially in the current economic climate. That automatic stabilizing effect means that retirees' expenditures are not going to be as vulnerable to the ups and downs of the stock market. And that there's a very steady amount of economic stimulus that's benefiting local communities, whether that's in good times or in bad. If the committee can give me a few more minutes, I appreciate how generous you are being with the time. I'd also like to review some of the findings of a report that we released last year in 2008 called A Better Bang for the Buck, the Economic Efficiencies of Defined Benefit Pensions.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Every once in a while, just say what page you're on, too, because that'll help the committee members.
Okay, absolutely. I'll try to do that. So right now, turning to slide 24, the reason why we wanted to do this study was to evaluate claims that defined contribution plans, or in the way that I'm going to refer to them in this presentation is DC plans, save money as compared with traditional pensions or defined benefit pension plans. I'll refer to those as DB plans. And what we wanted to do in this study is really measure on sort of apples-to-apples basis how the cost to deliver a given amount of retirement income compared through a traditional defined benefit structure compared with a defined contribution plan structure. And the reason why we were interested in answering this question is that we know that in many states around the country, and even in the private sector, employers are examining how they're delivering retirement benefits. And so we wanted to really do a fair apples-to-apples comparison to gauge really what is the more efficient way to deliver retirement benefits. So what we did was we modeled a population of 1,000 female teachers. And the reason we made them female was really just for simplifying the modeling. We could have made them men and women. And the results really wouldn't materially change at all. They work for 30 years, and their final salary when they retire is about $50,000. And on that basis, we defined a target retirement benefit, which is actually quite close to the average level of retirement benefits being received by retirees in Alaska right now, about $2,200 a month. And we have these folks begin receiving these benefits at age 62, and these benefits are adjusted for inflation. So that's kind of what we said is the target benefit. We said if the job or the goal is to make sure that we can provide this population of teachers a retirement benefit of $2,200 a month that will last, basically the duration of their lifetime, what would that cost to fund that benefit under a defined benefit program, and then funding the same level of benefit under a defined contribution plan structure? And what we found was that the defined benefit approach ended up saving money, quite a lot of money, compared to the defined contribution approach for three reasons. First is that defined benefit plans do a much better job at pooling what economists and actuaries refer to as longevity risk. And what we mean by longevity risks are the risk that, or essentially the uncertainty that an individual has as to what their ultimate lifespan will be. We don't know that in advance, so we don't know if we'll be lucky enough to celebrate our 100th birthday or if we'll just live to the average life expectancy. We don't know that in advance as individuals. However, actuaries are pretty good at predicting for a large enough population what the experience of a large group of people will be. And so because of that, a defined benefit plan, which is sort of a group-based plan, can manage those longevity risks much more efficiently than individuals who have to really kind of oversave. They have to save a lot more money in a defined contribution plan to ensure that they won't outlive their savings. By contrast, a defined benefit program only needs to make sure that it has enough money set aside to fund the average life expectancy of a large group of people. And that ends up saving quite a lot of money, and I'll run through those numbers in a moment. The second reason that we found that the defined benefit approach saves money was that defined benefit plans can maintain a better portfolio diversification over time. Those of us who have 401k plans or individual retirement accounts, we hear from financial advisors that as we get older, we should become much more conservative with our investments. And that's good advice, and that is what individuals should do. Because as we age, we have less of an ability to bear risk, and we need to insure against downside risk. In other words, the risk of a market decline. Now, a defined benefit plan, because it always has a mixture of older folks, middle-aged folks, and younger folks, it can maintain a more diversified portfolio kind of at every point in time. And as a result, generate enhanced returns, which makes providing the benefits much cheaper. The third reason that we found, and again, this is something that economists have spent quite a lot of time studying, is the actual investment performance of professionally managed defined benefit plans as compared with individual investors in their 401k accounts. Study after study after study has found a performance gap, and it's persistent, and it's there whether you look in good times or in bad times, and it ends up translating into a big difference in terms of the cost of delivering retirement benefits, because, you know, not surprisingly, the professionals, they just do a better job. You know, again, probably not surprising, and that's been validated by study after study when economists have looked at this. So in terms of what we found in the numbers, when we made this calculation of what it would cost in terms of, as a percentage of payroll, what it would cost to provide a benefit of $2,200 a month, starting at age 62, we found that it would cost about 12.5% of payroll for this particular group that we were talking about, this particular group of teachers. Then we turned to what would it cost to replicate that same benefit under a defined contribution approach. So what we found was that because the defined contribution approach did have these relative inefficiencies as compared with the defined benefit program, we found additional costs layering on. So the first sort of layer came from the fact that individuals saving on their own for retirement in a defined contribution program really have to oversave for retirement. In other words, they need to make sure that they have enough money, that they'll never outlive it, even if they are lucky enough to celebrate their 100th birthday. And so as a result, that requires a lot more money up front. Comparing it with the defined benefit plan that takes the contribution from 12.5% of payroll up to about 16% of payroll. Mm-hmm. The second effect that I talked about, the fact that defined benefit plans can maintain a very diversified portfolio over time, whereas individuals, we need to become more conservative as we age, added a little bit of cost on. That effect wasn't as large as you might think it might be, but it brought the cost up to 17% of payroll. And then the final effect was really the largest one that had to do with the benefits of a professionally managed portfolio. And even though we were very conservative in our assumptions here, we really wanted to take the low end of those estimates of the performance differential between defined benefit and defined contribution plans. So we only assumed a 1% per year difference. In other words, we assume that the defined benefit plan earns returns of about 8% a year, and we assume that the defined contribution plan earned about 7% a year. So that doesn't seem like very much, only a 1% difference a year in investment returns. But what happens is that compounds over time to have an enormous effect. And as a result, what that did is it drove the cost of the DC plan up to almost 23% of payroll. So what we concluded was that essentially, the defined benefit plan was able to offer the same, to deliver, you know, a given target retirement benefit, was able to do it at about 46% lower cost as compared with a typical defined contribution approach. And so, as a result, we concluded that a lot of the time when there's an assumption out there that a defined contribution approach is sort of a silver bullet approach to reducing retirement plan costs, we think that that there is something missing in that conversation. And I think really what it is that sometimes when those claims are out there, you're not really doing that kind of apples to apples comparison. Another way of looking at sort of, rather than as a percentage of payroll, we also wanted to run some numbers based on just the assets that would be needed, basically on the eve of retirement, right before that employee retired at age 62. And we found that the defined benefit plan only needed to accumulate for each person in the plan about $350,000. I mean, that's a lot of money, but compared with what would need to be accumulated in the defined contribution plan, which was over $500,000, so $550,000. Again, this is on slide 33. You can see that you're talking real money here. So what did we conclude from this exercise? Well, we concluded that defined benefit plans, because they have these built-in economic efficiencies, they really can provide a better bang for the buck. In other words, for a given level of retirement benefit, a defined benefit approach is going to be a more economically efficient way to deliver those benefits as compared with a defined contribution approach. And we think that this is very important for our taxpayers and for employers to understand because, of course, myself as a taxpayer, I'm concerned that, about smart use of tax dollars going in. I'm concerned with when expenditures are made, that they're being used in the most economically efficient way possible to achieve a certain objective. And here, the objective is providing retirement benefits. It was very clear that there were very significant economies associated with that DB approach.
Okay.
At this moment, I know I've taken up quite a lot of time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No, your presentation was very succinct. It was excellent, but I do want the committee members to be having an opportunity here for any comments or questions. And I now would ask, is there any members here that? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. We really appreciate it, as I said. And we have a lot of people here who want to give testimony.
Senator.
And let's see, should we start with... Jim Snowman. Jim, would you keep your...
It's Jill. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jill. I'm sorry. Come forward, please, and state your name and affiliation.
And perhaps I should have changed my profession, but perhaps I will, should this retirement plan not change. My name is Jill Showman, and... I'm the president of the Matsu Education Association. First of all, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. It's good to see some of you again. I know we were on the same flight down from Anchorage last night. So I'm here representing about 1,200 educators from Glacier View Elementary School to Trapper Creek Elementary in the Matsu Valley. And I've got to tell you that we're quite concerned, district administration, as well as the Teachers Association and the community, regarding the retention and recruitment of highly qualified educators. In the past 3 or so years, we've looked at about 90 to 100 teachers in terms of rehiring, retired. Finding new teachers is a problem, and retaining them is also. Those 90 to 100 teachers, that's about 8-9% of our teaching force. The district's having a hard time finding educators and keeping them, and it's primarily due to the DC plan, as well as the lack of Social Security. They go to job fairs at the Captain Cook in Anchorage, as well as Fairbanks, but they have to also supplement
with going outside East Coast, Midwest, as well as Pacific Northwest to find teachers. And each time the district hires a new teacher, then of course they have to pay, provide professional development, and you're looking at maybe about $100,000 over a couple of years there in terms of leave time, materials, training, etc. That's a cost that that our districts would not have to be burdened with, obviously, if we were able to retain staff. On a personal note, I am a TERS tier tour. This is my 12 and a half years of teaching. Like I said, I may have to change my profession, not just due to my my handwriting skills, but also because of the retirement. And I've got to mention as well that I also teach an undergrad ed class here with UAS. When students either at the high school level or at the college level ask me about going into teaching, I've got to be honest with them and tell them that it's not as great of a profession as it once was, and that's primarily due to the retirement. I tell them that they either need to look outside Alaska or they need to look at other professions. And that really saddens me because I think education is, we've got to have it for our entire society. So I would urge you to pass SB 23. I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, let me know.
Okay, thank you, Jill. Does any members have any questions of Jill? Okay, thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Jim Lepley. You did?
No, I don't have a question. I wonder if we could turn that machine off on that and turn our lights back on, maybe?
Yes, could we do that? Debbie, would you get the lights back on, please?
And that machine's really buzzing, and that thing behind your neck doesn't help you either.
Yeah. We'll just take a short at ease and get that.
That's better. Now I can see you guys.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. My name is Jim Lepley. I'm president of the Anchorage Education Association, representing 3,500 plus teachers of Anchorage. Madam Chair and other members of the committee, I thank you very much for your support of this bill, and I encourage you to do whatever you can to promote it through the process that you guys know a whole lot more of than I do. As I told Senator Meyer last night on the plane, I'm a rookie at this, so be gentle with me, please.
Okay, are there any questions from Jim? Okay. All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Next. That was gentle, yeah.
It was pretty gentle.
Pat Lobe is online, correct? From AARP.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Would you like to give testimony at this time, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Moody. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. Lifetime financial security is a cornerstone of the American dream. You work hard, follow the rules, you'll be able to retire without financial worries. But AARP has a major concern. Most of our public employees do not participate in Social Security. You cannot outlive Social Security. In the past, it didn't matter so much that our public employees did not participate in Social Security. They had a defined benefit plan that would last as long as they lived. But now, they have no defined benefit, they have no Social Security. The American dream of a secure financial retirement no longer exists for Alaska's newly hired public employee. It is possible to make a defined contribution plan work for you, as long as you don't live too long. But most of us will live into our mid-80s, many of us into our 90s. If a DC plan is to work for you, you need to know your life expectancy. If you're married, how long will your spouse live? Will you be healthy right up until your heart stops beating? Or will you need some type of long-term care, Medicare doesn't pay for home health or nursing homes. You're responsible for that bill. What will inflation be for the next 20 years? Defined benefit and Social Security plans provide annual COLAs. The new DC plan doesn't. Will there be inflation in health care costs over the next 20 years? Any chance your utility bills will go up? What are the odds that fuel oil or natural gas may cost more? How about gasoline? You better have a crystal ball to make a defined contribution plan work for you. It is true that many companies have switched from defined benefit to defined contribution plans over the past few years. But all of us who work in the private sector have Social Security. No matter how much or how little we save in 401ks or IRAs, we will always have the defined benefit plan of Social Security, and it will last as long as we live. Our public employees used to have the same financial security before Senate Bill 141. No matter how long they lived, no matter what bad luck life circumstances dealt them, they would not starve, they would not end up on public assistance.
Pat, could you conclude, please, your testimony, because it's going on just a little bit long. Thank you.
They teach our grandchildren, they put out our home fires, they respond when we call for police assistance. We don't want these honorable public servants to help us their entire career and then worry about their health coverage or whether they will outlive their savings when they retire. They deserve better than that. Please support Senate Bill 23 and give them the security that they deserve.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat. And I don't know if I gaveled this back in after Eddie's, but I will now. I'm sorry. Next we have off net is Lawrence Weiss, Alaska Center for Public Policy. Lawrence, are you there? And could you state your name and affiliation, please?
Yes, I am. I am here. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my name is Dr. Lawrence Weiss. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Center for Public Policy. I'm also a TERS Tier 1 retiree. I taught at the University of Alaska Anchorage for quite a few years. Now, I really wanted to take one little piece of this discussion and talk about it for, well, I guess I have 2 minutes. I want to talk about the concept of the unfunded liability, because this is thrown around quite a bit. I've heard it in testimony in recent weeks. You know, the figure of $7.5 billion, $15.8 billion. And, you know, this way of looking at the pension plan, a defined benefit plan, really is geared towards obscuring the facts and creating a kind of a sense of panic in the public about the actual status of the plan.
Dr. Weiss, I'm sorry. I apologize that you must not have heard. I'm only allowing a minute testimony because we have so much to get through on this. So if you could just hit the highlights and take about 30 seconds more, please.
Okay, will do. If you buy a house with a 30-year mortgage, you say you owe $500,000. Well, one way of looking at this is to develop heart palpitations because you only earn maybe $50,000 or $70,000 a year, and there is no way you can come up with this unfunded liability of $500,000. Of course, the other way of understanding it is that you owe $500,000 over 30 years, and that comes out to some very, you know, relatively reasonable monthly payments. And the unfunded liabilities and pensions are very similar. They really need to be analyzed over 25 or 30 years in order to understand what they mean. Because the definition of an unfunded liability is the amount by which the liabilities of a program exceed program assets at a given date. That last part's very important. I'm almost done here. What will the unfunded liability be in 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years? Actuaries can tell you that, and it is far more useful information than harping on the unfunded liability at any one point in time, especially now. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weiss. Next, we'll go to Fairbanks, and we have Donald Callahan online. Would you state your affiliation and your name, please, and give a minute testimony? Thank you.
I'm Donald Callahan. I'm a lifelong Fairbanks, and I'm in the Tier 1 retirement system. Since you don't know, I've got gray hair. I'm 68 years old. I went to the University of Alaska, graduated as a civil engineer. I worked as a city engineer and public works director. At 41, because of stress of politics and lack of monetary or personal rewards, I became a paramedic. I retired after 30 years of the city system with what I thought was a great retirement system. after 30 years. Right now, I think I've lost about 30% of my retirement due to inflation. My mutual funds right now, if I had to live on them as a deferred contribution plan, would last me about 3 years. I'd have to sell my house here in Fairbanks and move out somewhere in the States and maybe last maybe 3 or 4 years on what I'd get from my home. I take and go to breakfast with union retirees, and every one of them gets a better retirement than I do. My son graduated from the University of Alaska, magna cum laude, computer science. He went 8 years to Japan. He came back here and he's become a teacher in 2006. He went to summer school to get his teaching certificate. He worked a whole year free for the state of Alaska as a teacher, a student teacher. His pay is a little over $40,000 a year. Last summer, he worked on his master's degree, so he had 2 weeks off last summer. He purchased a house with my help because I used to be a realtor part-time, and we had a very difficult time finding a house. He qualified for just a little over $200,000 home, which doesn't buy anything except a condo in Fairbanks anymore.
Okay, Donald, could you wrap it up, please? Thank you.
Well, you also ought to know that teachers in their retirement, they return the state, but working Summer Arts Festival, Arctic Winter Games, Ice Art Alaska, they work on Relay for Life. This is teachers, retired teachers in Fairbanks, all the things they contribute after they retire with their state retirement. Thank you very much, and I have a lot more to say. But
thank you, Donald.
I'll put it in writing and send it to you.
We do appreciate that. Thank you. We'll look forward to that correspondence. Next, we'll go to Kenai. We only have two other people, so I think we can get through this testimony this morning. LaDon Drews from Kenai Peninsula Education Association. And can you keep your remarks, please, to 1 minute? Thank you.
Jim, I'll try. Good morning, Senator Menard and the members of the committee. I am LaDon Drews, president of the KPEA, which represents over 600 certified teachers and specialists in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. I received an email yesterday with a new teacher regarding wanting to ask me some questions regarding her retirement and Social Security. I will be visiting with her tomorrow. On the Social Security issue, I will mention NEA's fight on the national federal level to right the injustice of the windfall elimination provision. Regarding her own retirement, I would like to report that our state legislator is certain to return the public employees and teachers of Alaska to a defined benefit program. When looking at the numbers, let's take to heart what Representative Book said yesterday in the discussion of HB 30. We need a cost analysis for all parties involved, including the retirees. But I would also caution, let's not get lost in the numbers. Refer to the MasterCard commercial that we're all familiar with if there are some things that are priceless. Our public employees and teachers provide priceless services to our communities. Young people coming out of college and training programs today are educated regarding their retirement. They've seen their parents lose their retirements in 401 type pension plans and are being cautioned to plan for a more secure future. Let's not wait until it's too late. Let's not continue to be on the cutting edge of this type of legislation. We will regret it. Please move SB 23 to Senate Finance. Thank you.
Thank you, LaDon, for your testimony. Next, we have Melody Douglas from Soldotna, the CFO for Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. Melody.
Thank you, Senator Menard, members of the committee. My name is Melody Douglas. I'm the CFO for the Kenai School District, fourth largest in the state of Alaska. I have been actively involved in communicating the district's concerns relative to FERS and TERS retirement plans since spring of 2003. This is an ability to pay issue. And I want to thank you for the $19.3 million that came to our district in FY08, similar funding as planned for FY09. $17.2 million of that was for TERS retirement purposes. And continued legislative support into the future is critical to KPBSD. This funding approximates in on-behalf payments of about 41.47% for TERS. I'm now going to tell you that we had 596 full-time equivalency teaching staff in FY08. That salaries and benefits equal about 80% of our budget. $17.2 million equals 274 FTE. Class sizes would have virtually doubled in our district. We would have not made, in my opinion, AYP in FY08. To date, in consulting with our HR department, none of the new hires hired by HR have expressed concern over the DC plan, and none of the exiting teachers in their exit interviews have expressed concern over the DC plan. We hired 76 teachers in 08, 107 in 09, and we're expecting to hire 75 for 10. The next time the numbers are released, the unfunded liability will be probably in the neighborhood of $10 billion. That debt must be paid. The public sector can no longer fund the DB plan, so please stay the course set in place right now and maintain the DC plan until we can actually truly evaluate it. It's only been in place less than 3 years.
So, Melody, you're speaking against the bill?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Does anyone on the committee have any questions or comments? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony then. Do any committee members have anything else that they'd want to add? I noticed that we have a second fiscal note now. The first one was, and I guess I would address this to Senator Passavant, was like $17 million. Now they've come in with $782 million.
No, I think it's the fiscal note of March 16th, which is the $14 million for fiscal year 2011 is $14,245,000. And then there was a revised fiscal note that I believe we just got yesterday, which is for a 2010, that's $752,000. Not million.
Oh, okay.
And I believe right. That, and then for like fiscal year 2011, it's an extra $84,000. And I believe that those are just additional transition costs.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Shire.
I thought they were really getting their gloves off against this bill.
No, that those are thousands, you. Not millions.
Thank you for that clarification on that. What is the will of the committee? Do I hear a motion to move this bill out? Okay, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, before I make a motion to move the bill out, we may just want to clarify because it seems like we're going rapidly here through a very important subject, but many of us served on the previous committee that this bill was heard in Labor and Commerce, and there was numerous changes made to the bill there that certainly meets my satisfaction. So I am prepared to move the bill out, and the rest of the committee members are. So with that, Madam Chair, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 23, Labor and Commerce, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move Senate Bill 23, Repeal Defined Contribution Retirement passes out of state affairs onto the next committee of referral. And we'll just take a brief at ease while Debbie gets us. Next, we're going to hear Senate Bill 129, Residential Sprinkler Systems. Senate Bill 120 is my bill, and I'll be having my very capable staff person, Michael Rivito, present it. Michael, for the record, would you please identify yourself and affiliation? And we're speeding things up today.
Yes, we are. Well, for the record, good morning. My name is Michael Rivito. I'm a staff member to Senator Menard. Senate Bill 129 is a response to a national movement to mandate fire sprinkler systems in one- and two-family dwellings new construction. This legislation before you today does not prohibit Alaskans from choosing to install these systems in their new or existing homes. It simply prohibits any attempt to make them mandatory at the state or local level. Now, residential fire sprinkler systems are expensive. Conservative estimates indicate that Alaskans could expect to pay between $3 to $5 per square foot to have a system included in the construction of their new home. The fact is, mandating sprinklers in new one- or two-family homes is excessive, and it puts further financial burden on a buyer who is already purchasing a house built with updated and modern fire safety standards. For instance, changes in residential construction technology over the last 20 years have dramatically dropped the number of fatal fires in the United States. code provisions for fire separation, fire blocking, and draft stopping, emergency escape and rescue openings, electrical circuit breakers, capacity and outlet spacing, reduced need for space heaters in energy-efficient homes, and many other improvements have made our homes more fire safe without undue financial burden to the homeowner. Also keep in mind the number of private wells that families in Alaska are on. About 33% of residents in this state utilize private well systems, and requiring a sprinkler system would be very problematic for these homeowners. It will lead to requirements for a larger well with increased flow and other modifications to that well that can add thousands of dollars onto the price tag of this house. But financial burden aside, there is always that risk for a sprinkler system that could malfunction or somehow be triggered erroneously. In that scenario, not only does the homeowner have to deal with a severely water-damaged home, but then the risk of mold presents itself as that water gets behind walls and into other cracks and crevices in the house. And as everybody knows, mold in a house is a serious health risk that people face. What studies do show is the effectiveness of standard smoke alarms that already exist in many homes. They have a proven track record of alerting people to fires and saving lives. And if a smoke alarm malfunctions, as it malfunctions, it's not going to douse your home in gallons and gallons of water. So in closing, simply, Senate Bill 129 is not designated to prohibit It's not meant to prohibit people from installing these systems. It's just seeking to prohibit mandating them for new home construction, adding on this cost. This bill has support of home builders, real estate agents, and many citizens have contacted us concerned about the added cost to a home because of any mandating of sprinkler systems. So with that, I have in the audience today Mr. Paul Michelson, and he's an expert who sits on the International Code Council and is on other boards, and he can answer technical questions for you better than I could if you have any.
Okay, we're going to hold off with that a little bit. Are there any committee members here that have questions? Senator Kukesh.
Two questions. Usually when we have a bill like this, we have a problem that's looming someplace. Where is the concern, and why are we so adamant about trying to do this? I don't know anybody in the region that I represent that is jumping up and down saying somebody's going to force me to put sprinkler systems in. Let's stop it.
Sure. Through the chair to Senator Kukesh, this is a kind of a proactive response to something that's been a national movement. The International Residential Code, which is often adopted widely throughout the United States, the individuals involved with determining these codes have pushed to mandate these sorts of sprinkler systems. So as opposed to having to be reactive if this does come our way, it's kind of a proactive response to stop it before anybody could attempt to mandate these things on new homeowners.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Did you have a follow-up, Senator?
No, I did, but I think I'm okay.
And as a sponsor of the bill, too, I would say one of the biggest rubs is they don't want to take it out of the municipality, the opposers of this bill. They want the local level to be able to say, yes, we are going to have a new subdivision, and we want to demand that sprinkler systems be put in that. So that seems to be a rub against this bill. And Senator Pasvan, did you have a question?
Well, as a yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And welcome back to Juneau.
Thank you.
So we missed you yesterday. But anyway, my concern with this does address that second component, which is under the proposed 2935-144, which says a municipality may not require a fire protection system. And then subsection B says that applies to a home rule and general law municipalities. And in speaking with the building official in Fairbanks, and it's not the official policy of the city, I mean, you know, he's just expressing concern to me. He understands why, for example, we might say the state fire marshal can't mandate it for Albert Kukesh's district, or may not mandate it for my district, or mandate it for anyone's district. But the question is why shouldn't discretion, or why shouldn't that be left at the local level, is the issue that they're concerned about. And again, I appreciate your proactive issue, but the way it's currently written, even if they had valid, sound reasons for doing it in the future, this would prohibit them from making that determination. And so kind of why is that included in here?
Right. And through the chair to Senator Passman, I think that the original intent was to just to prevent against wide general mandates of this, of just taking, like you said, taking a whole general area and saying, okay, everybody in this area has to have a sprinkler system. I see what you're saying about the case-by-case basis. Is that
looking at a jurisdiction, a home rule like Fairbanks, you know, to say, look, they know whether you were talking about wells. Well, if everyone in Fairbanks is not on a well,
right,
if they are on a system and, you know, and technology is at the point where they just say it can be done the way the law is currently drafted, it would bar them from saying it's reasonable to include that in a residence. And that's, he's not saying that they are, he's not saying they aren't. He's saying, why is the state telling us we can't make a decision at the local level?
Right.
And I think some of these questions will be answered, too, as we go off net. There's going to be several firefighters that are going to testify, and then at the end we'll have Mr. Michaels come up and give testimony as well. So maybe some of those questions. It doesn't prohibit. I live out on a homestead. I have a well. If I want to put in a sprinkler system, it doesn't prohibit me from spending the money to do it. It's just one of those mandates that we're trying to avoid in this bill. So with that, we'll go off net to Fairbanks and Warren Cummings, and he is the Western Fire Chief with the Western Fire Chief Association. And could you just keep your comments to 1 minute, please, because I'm trying to get through all of this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I've emailed you a copy of my experience with residential home sprinklers. I'll submit it here as written testimony and have it sent down. But it just shows that the sprinklers aren't as expensive as you're talking about. My experience, though, it's back from my addition that I put on, it was my whole sprinkler system cost $2,786 to put in, and I've had no accidental discharges. I've had the sprinkler system for 30 years.
And could you tell us how much square feet you have in your residential home, please?
The original was 1,900 square feet, and then I put an additional 904 square feet on in 1994, so about 2,800 square feet.
And all 2,800 square feet has the sprinkler system in it?
That's correct.
Okay, and you said the cost was not larger than
$2,000? $2,786 was the cost. And
what year did you put that in, please?
The original system was put in 1979. The addition was put in 1994.
Okay, thank you.
It should be interesting to note that the addition in 1994, that the cost of that addition was $1,382. And the flooring that I put in the addition was $1,673.
Well, you must have did all the work yourself.
No, I was contracted out. I had a contractor that did it.
Okay, thank you. Is there any last comments, Mr. Cummins?
I'm going to also submit his testimony as a newspaper article from Anchorage on Lone Survivor. It's about the family that four people perished in a trailer fire in the Sedona area, and it gives you a very good example of what happens during a fire and what can be prevented by sprinkler systems. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Next, we'll go to Ketchikan. And before I do that, though, I failed to ask committee members if they had any further questions from Michael Rivito. Okay. All right. Now we'll go to Jim Hill, and he's with the Ketchikan Fire Department. Could you keep your comments to 1 minute, please, Jim?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Jim Hill. I'm the fire chief in Ketchikan. Sprinkler systems save lives. We've been fighting this battle for years and years, and to keep it short and sweet, what we would like to do is to keep this keep the discretion at the local level. We understand that rural communities and places that don't have water systems, that they may have issues. But if we work with we work with the builders and we work with the residents and educate people. That may be the way to go that way, but don't take the discretion and don't take our local powers away from us with this bill.
Okay.
Thanks very much. That's all I had.
And then, Jim, I would ask you, do you have a sprinkler system in your residence?
No, ma'am. I bought my house here. It's 50 years old. I would love to, and in fact, I may do it someday.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Richard Tombaugh from, again, Ketchikan Fire Department.
Richard just stepped out for a few minutes.
Okay, I'll give him an opportunity. I'll go to Sitka and come back to him then.
All right, thanks,
if
ma'am.
You give him that information. We'll go to Sitka next. And would you like to testify, Dave Miller, from the Alaska State Firefighters Association and Senate Bill 129?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much for listening to me for another time here. I would just like to say we're opposed to that bill. We think it ought to be left to the local levels to be able to do that. I think the big thing is that nowadays it seems like houses are being built closer together again. And as a fire starts and spreads, it's harder to keep it away from those other houses. The faster that we can attack those fires and get them done, the better it is to save other structures as well as lives go. There was just a fire in Washington in the Tacoma area. One structure on fire, four other houses were on fire because of that. Those are the things that we need to stop. Construction nowadays, lightweight construction burns quicker. It's a great thing, but it burns quicker. When we started fighting fire, 25 years ago, we had about 17 minutes. If we could get there within 15 to 17 minutes, we were able to stop a fire generally. Now it's down to like 4 or 5 minutes. So we're opposed to it, and we thank you very much for listening to us, ma'am.
Thank you. Next, we'll have Jeff Turner, Alaska Fire Chief. Jeff?
Yes, thank you, Senator Bernard. This is Jeff Tucker. I represent the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, the Interior Fire and also the Interior Fire Chiefs Association. We are opposed to this, the Senate Bill 129. There is no national mandate to require residential sprinkler systems. The state of Alaska has no powers to adopt the residential sprinkler systems. This bill ultimately prohibits local control and local options to adopt residential sprinkler systems. It's a proven technology. And what this bill does, as been previously stated, takes away the local option for fire departments, for local municipal authorities, for the home rule departments and agencies to make the decision at a local level. And that's my testimony, and I'll stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you, Jeff Tucker. I am sorry they put Turner instead of Tucker. So next.
All right,
okay, we'll go back to Jeff Wilczek, Chinook Fire.
Yes, thank you, Senator. My name is Jeff Wilczek. We oppose this bill on the fact that there is some misnomers in there, and the fact that the cost is something comparable to carpet in a home. The fact that you have immediate fire protection within a home, and you're not waiting on a response time or a fire department, gives you that ability to suppress that system and get people out of the home. You're looking at saving lives and as well as firefighters' lives. So I do have a fire sprinkler system in my home that I installed when it was being built, and I've never had an accidental discharge in it, and it's a real peace of mind to have that system in my home for my family.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Any last comment? Okay, next we'll go to Mike Molesky from Palmer. Mike?
Thank you, Senator Menard and members of the committee. I'm speaking as a council member from the city of Palmer, and I'm speaking in opposition basically to the bottom line of this proposed bill. Because of our home rule status, we adopt the Unified Building Code with exceptions. And to my knowledge, this is the first time a restriction of this sort is being placed upon us, taking away local control. And I'm speaking literally to the bottom line where B reads, this section applies to home rule. I cannot speak specifically to the merits of a fire sprinkler system, but from what I have heard, there is certainly enough discussion to warrant further discussion. And I once again just draw attention to the fact of a restriction placed upon us as a home rule entity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And do you and Lee have a fire system, sprinkler system in your residence?
We do not at the present time, but what this discussion has done is generate our thoughts as we're continuing our remodeling and the value of doing such.
Okay, thank you, Mike, and my best to Lee. Next, we have Pat Thompson, and she is representing herself.
Yeah, he is. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to make this short and concise here. I think what we're looking at here with Senate Bill 129 is an unnecessary step by the legislature and this committee into the model code process. The model codes are developed nationally and then adopted locally, and there's always the option at the local level to amend, adjust, delete whatever is suited for the local codes. And I don't think that the legislature or this committee should get mired in this discussion, nor should it get mired in discussions with things like R values of insulation or snow loads for roofs, those kind of things that are in the codes. I would want to touch just briefly on some history from smoke alarms, which have been touted as being a great thing recently, and it's no question that they are a great thing. They cut the number of fire deaths to half what they used to be. When they came along in the 60s and the 70s, they were quite expensive, and the same people that are saying this is the greatest thing that you could ever use in a home to save lives were fighting the inclusion of smoke alarms at that time. Smoke alarms in the 70s cost as much as $200 a piece. In today's money, that's $1,000. It was a significant outlay of money, but yet we saw it implemented into the model codes and eventually became standard, and I can't imagine anybody out there today would be in a house and knowingly be in that house without a smoke alarm in it.
Okay, thank you, Pat. Next, we'll go to Dave Tyler, Fire Chief. Mr. Tyler?
My name is David Tyler, and I'm a state fire marshal. And I just want to make a couple clarifications, if I might. Some previous testimony a couple days ago was stated that in the IBC, I had certain authority to bring this type of codes into place, and that's not true. I don't get my authority, or the DTS doesn't get its authority from the building code. It's a statute, and the statute specifically limits us on what codes we can adopt. One of the concerns I have with this legislation is the effect it will have on assisted living facilities and daycare facilities that provide coverage for kids, you know, between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. We'd also not be able to require sprinklers for those, and that's the heart of what we try to do is protect citizens, and in this case, citizens that don't necessarily have the abilities to protect themselves. I think with that, in the spirit of trying to keep things short, I can take any questions that you might have.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Kelly Nicolo?
My name is Kelly Nicolo. I'm the Assistant State Fire Marshal, and I was just making myself available for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Kelly. Any questions? We'll move then to David Owens, Matsu Home Builders. David, are you online? Then we'll go to Nick Bakick.
Madam Chair, this is Dave Owens from
Okay, Paula. All right. Could you state your name and affiliation, please, and give a minute testimony?
Thank you, ma'am. My name is David R. Owens. I'm representing myself and the Matsu Home Builders. I'm the owner of Owens Inspection Services based in Palmer. I've been a building inspector for 25 years, 10 of those years with the municipality of Anchorage. I support this legislation. I think with the upgrades in building standards in the last 10 years with smoke detectors, CO detectors, fire separation between house and garage, and more recently the arc fault protection that we do build very safe 1 and 2 family dwellings. I feel it's unreasonable to ask the general public to make it mandatory to put in fire sprinklers because of the cost. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. And then let's go back to Ketchikan. Is Richard Tombaugh on now? Is he off net?
No, ma'am. He's out doing an inspection. Sorry about that.
Okay. We'll give him one last chance here. Well, okay, so he's out doing an inspection. He's probably not going to come back in.
Yeah, he's in the same building, but if he comes back shortly, I'll...
Okay. Will you respectfully tell him that we did try to get him on a couple times?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. And Nick Bakick from Accel Fire Systems. So...
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak with all of you about this issue. I am opposed to this bill. I've been in the fire protection industry for 20 years. Just 3 months ago, the state of Alaska 2010 governor's operating budget came out for the Department of Public Safety, Fire and Life Safety Operations. It's online and available for anyone. It's stated in there on page 3 that Alaska has a history of tragic fire loss. The state is experiencing an increase in civilian fatalities due to fire. Civilian fire deaths increased from 12 in fiscal year 04 to 20 in 06 to 24 in 07. All but three occurred in residential occupancies. Residential occupancy fires continue to be Alaska's largest number of structure fires, accounting for 75% of the state's total, or 998 of all structure fires. Of the 14 deaths, 13 have occurred in residential dwellings. Currently, the Division of Fire and Life Safety has no authority to enforce single-family residential code requirements. This bill would certainly keep them from being able to enforce this and would continue the rise in deaths that are going on out there. Smoke detectors are easy to disable. People pull the 9-volt battery out and it no longer works, so you have no notification. A sprinkler system never goes to sleep. It doesn't require a battery. It's always there and it will protect the house. Been proven in Scottsdale, Arizona, there was a 10-year study done with a requirement for sprinklers in the dwellings, and it saved lives and it saved money. We don't have to theorize or guess about the positive effects of fire sprinklers in homes. This Scottsdale sprinkler ordinance proves beyond a doubt that they work and they save money for the municipality as well as saving lives. One thing I'd like to say from the contractor, he made a few statements about a proactive and a reactive. The International Association of Fire Chiefs, that was part of this Scottsdale initiative, had two definitions for reactive and proactive fire protection. Reactive being traditional fire protection, where a problem has occurred before it's addressed with building codes, and I hope that the fire department resources that have been amassed are able to beat the clock and arrive soon enough to have a positive impact on the emergency incident. Whereas proactive fire protection is the philosophy is accomplished by embracing new proven technology and built-in protection like automatic sprinklers and early detection systems, combined with an aggressive code enforcement and strong public education programs.
Okay.
The state continues to try and let the public know about these things. The fire sprinkler systems cannot be stopped. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. And now we'll go to Bob Weinstein from the city of Ketchikan, the mayor.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman.
Could you keep it to 1 minute, please?
I'll do my best. My name is Bob Weinstein. I'm mayor of the city of Ketchikan, as you stated, and like many of your communities, we're not exactly a bastion of over-government regulation. I will say the city of Ketchikan recently went through an extended public process as we adopted updated fire and building codes. One of the largest issues was whether or not sprinklers should be required in residential buildings. We had extensive dialogue with the Local Builders Association, and at the end of the day, developed language mutually agreeable to both the city and builder so that sprinklers would be required in residential buildings which lacked access to firefighting equipment and vehicles and for which reasonable alternatives did not exist. This is a very important issue in Ketchikan, which, as you may know, has many homes located on wooden staircases or on steep terrain. We have lost such homes to fire because of lack of access. Such fires not only destroy the home itself, but threaten neighboring homes as well. The passage of this legislation would, in effect, veto the actions of the Ketchikan City Council and have an adverse impact on the public safety of our citizens. Please delete Section 29.35.144, which is, I guess, Section 4, and let communities like ours make our own decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next and final person to testify would be Paul Michelson, Alaska State Home Builders Association. Would you come forward and state your name and affiliation, please, Paul, and try to keep it quick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, appreciate your time to give me the opportunity to present the case. My name is Paul Michelson, M-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-H-N. I'm a builder out of Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm a director on the Alaska State Home Builders Board, a member of the ICC Council Boards, a member of the NAHB Codes Boards, a member of the Municipality of Anchorage Codes Boards, and here I sit. There's so many things that could be disputed here. Fire sprinklers do go to sleep. It's been recognized that people turn off their smoke alarms, let the batteries wear out. What is to prevent a child, a homeowner, from shutting off the water system? It's no different than shutting off your toilet, shutting off your sink. It can go to sleep. The deaths nationally, deaths have been reduced by over 70% nationally in the past 20 years due to the better quality of homes being built in America today. There was a mention of a fire where in Washington where one went on fire and four followed up. A sprinkler system would not help in that case because the sprinkler system supposedly protects the inside of the residence, not the outside. If a house burns and burns from the outside in, a fire sprinkler is not going to do a thing for it before it has substantial damage. The issue on deaths in Alaska, we have a lot of older homes in Alaska, a lot of underdeveloped homes in Alaska. I think if the statistics were brought forth accurately, you will see that the fire deaths occurring in Alaska are in houses that are older than 20 or 25 years old. They don't even have proper water systems, no less the ability to put a sprinkler system in. The sprinkler system code is targeted at new construction, not at your trailers. I don't even think you can sprinkle a trailer because there's not enough insulation in the surrounding walls to protect it from freezing. Smoke alarms do save lives. I think education saves lives. I think if the Fire Coalition puts some of their efforts into education of the public, telling them about smoke detectors, telling them about exit routes, telling them about safety of fires, I think it'd be a much more reasonable request than the request sprinkler systems. The question on sprinkler systems, everybody here today so far indicated and stated that right now it is not law. That is a correct statement. It is not law right now. The law was passed last September to be put into the 2009 IRC main body of the code. Prior to 2009, in the 2000 edition, the 2003 edition, and the 2006 edition, it was in the appendix of the code. The appendix is just a guideline. If you put a sprinkler system in, you go to the appendix, and that tells you the guidelines on to do a system. Now, the Fire Coalition was very successful in getting it into the body of the code. What people aren't telling you on the phone, that once the state adopts the IRC, which there is talk in the legislature right now about adopting a state code. If they do that and the state fire marshal or the state of Alaska adopts the code, then all the local jurisdictions will not have authority to amend it out. Because the code, the way the legislation reads, is that a local jurisdiction can amend or adjust a code to be more stringent but not less stringent than what has been adopted. This is why we are in favor of this SB 129. This is one area that we don't want to take the risk of having to come down here in a year from now and then talk about throwing the entire code out, which is happening in various states. Right now, this code, the same similar bill, has passed in North Dakota. It's waiting for the governor's signature. It's passed
Mr.
Idaho.
Michelson, in fairness to everybody else, I'm sorry if you
we
could
are
just...
We are in favor of SB 129. We ask for your support, and I am here to answer any questions you may have.
Do any members have a question? And then I have a question as well. Senator Meyer.
I do. Actually, it's good to have a builder here to ask this question to. And I think I agree with you, and certainly we have several fire marshals online, I could ask them as well, but I think most of the homes in Anchorage anyway, that do catch on fire are your older homes, or lately it's been a lot of the mobile homes, which, like you said, this wouldn't even help them. But like the smoke detectors in our homes, there's often false alarms. Like if you burn the bacon or something, then you know the smoke alarm goes off. Can you have the same thing happen with these sprinklers, where they go off when there's really not really a fire, and you come home and you see that your computers and your furniture's all been showered with water?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I don't know if they're so easily false detected through heat. You have to melt either the metal thing or pop the glass. There's a chemical in the glass which pops and releases the spring, which charges the system. They can be broken very easily with frisbees, with bats, with tennis rackets, with golf clubs, with clothes hangers hanging on them, and that is the fear. And by law, the homeowner is not allowed to shut the water system off if a sprinkler system activates. So you actually have to wait until someone of authority comes and then shuts it down. And at the average of 6 to 9 gallons a minute, it doesn't take very long to realize that you're going to have water everywhere. And then we go into a new problem of mold and of mildew and of heavy condensation in the house.
Okay, thank you.
Does that answer your question, sir?
I had a comment, and I'm sorry I never posed this question to you before when we spoke, but you mentioned firewalls back in the middle 70s. My husband and I built the first Wasilla Professional Building, and in order to do that, we had to put a firewall in. And you mentioned now that several of your new homes have firewalls. Can you explain to the committee a firewall?
Madam Chair, I don't know if they're actually called firewall. Fire separation wall, I think, is what you're saying. You built a commercial building, so you would have been required to have a fire separation wall to protect one tenant from the other. And that is happening on residential, where someone said the houses are getting closer and closer together. The code has actually been reduced. It used to be 5 foot between from property line to the house, and they've actually, in some cases, narrowed that down to 3 foot. But if you do it at 3 foot, then your eaves have to be protected by sheetrock, fire-rated plywood, and then you have to put double layer sheetrock on that wall only, and in some instances have to put fire glass. So these are all options that could be done. You can install fire rated siding, such as your cementous siding. You can stucco the exterior. You can put tempered glass on the exterior to stop the implosion of the fire. You can put wire glass if need be if the separation. So there's many options to be followed out there besides one saying fire sprinklers. Fire sprinklers, and biggest thing I think, Ron, it creates a false sense of security to the occupant of the house. And one other thing, if I may, I know I went over my time, but to back up, the assisted living and daycare centers would not be included in it because they are commercial. Commercial is regulated under the IBC, which says that you have to put sprinkler systems in these areas. So the municipalities would have the right to regulate that, so they'd be exempt from this bill that you set forth.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Michelson. And a question from Senator Passman.
What I am, I guess, interested in is, for example, the mayor of Ketchikan's indication that they dealt with this issue on a local level, and whatever the result is, what are your thoughts on saying that the local jurisdiction should work to address this issue? And again, particularly that issue of more restrictive, less restrictive than the state standard. I understand what you're saying there, but what about just giving the control at the local level?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, I happen to be quite familiar with the Ketchikan deal because I flew down there 4 times to testify at their level. The local authority tried to put it in place that all residential houses needed to have sprinkler systems. We caught wind of that, or someone from Ketchikan caught wind of that. We went down there. Presently, right now, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but the building official has told the people, well, you got your way last year, but it's in the code now, so we'll have it again. That's the wrong attitude to have, because we fought long. It was a very, very good discussion. Both sides, city council met with us, and they decided the area they're talking about, the very center of Ketchikan has, as I said, has wooden steps, steep steps, walkways, bridges. It was agreed upon that those areas, that small area jurisdiction, would have sprinkler systems or standpipes or hydrants of some sort, because it is impossible to get. The firemen have to carry all their gear, everything upstairs, down pathways. But a block and a half away from that, it's not necessary. So it was deemed that that area would not be under the jurisdiction of the fire sprinkler. The municipalities can offer you. Do a subdivision in Anchorage. The one in Anchorage has been brought up many times. It's the one in Potter Valley. Two blocks, a block below it and a block above it, do not require a sprinkler system. This one block requires a sprinkler system because that's the agreement that the developer made with the municipality of Anchorage to get the subdivision. There's many other ways they could have put hydrants in. They could have put assist pumps in. They could put better quality of construction, so that there's pros and cons that this does not take away from the municipality. The option is always there.
Is there any
negotiation? Else? Did that help answer your question?
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Passman?
Yes. Are you in favor then of if there's legislation passed that we should allow the local jurisdiction to have a say on the adoption of the building code containing sprinklers or any building code?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, I'm in favor of any municipality adopting the code and being able to amend it as they see fit for their jurisdiction. However, I state again, if the state in a year or 6 months or 17, 18 months from now adopts the IRC in its entirety, then no jurisdiction in the state is going to have the ability to amend out fire sprinklers. You'll have to put them in.
So would you characterize this as a proactive bill?
I would characterize this as a preventive maintenance position.
Proactive.
I foresee some other issues coming down the road.
Okay. Are there any other committee members that have any questions? Okay. Senator Kukesh.
Could you clarify for me your statement just a minute ago that if the state adopts that particular code, we would be preempted from doing anything? I mean, it seems to me that there's a position under that we were going to have to adopt something, but in order to adopt it, we would have to make a decision that we're making today. So it doesn't just get forced on us. We'd have the same discussion
through the chair.
Unless somebody else has that authority over us to adopt that particular code.
Right now, the codes that are currently adopted in the state, I do believe, are the IBC, UPC, the UMC, the IFC, the NEC, the IEECC.
I appreciate that. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about the one you said that we would
the
have.
IRC.
Uh-huh.
I don't know your process. We're trying to figure that out right now. What is the process to get a code adopted statewide?
I'm saying that if we did have to adopt a code statewide, we, the legislature, would have that determination in front of us. Nobody else would have that determination in front of them, so we would have an option of saying yes.
I don't know if that's a true statement, sir.
Then who would make a decision that would override the state legislature?
I've been asking that question right now. We asked that question of Mr. Click Bishop from the Department of Labor, because the codes are split where the Department of Labor has oversight and the State Fire Marshal has some oversight. So I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know if it goes in front of the legislature or not.
Okay, then for you to come here and say that it's going to be adopted is a misnomer, because you don't even know that.
Through the chair, Mr. Kukesh, I said we're trying to prevent this in the event that it gets adopted, because a lot of the areas are going to try to get this code adopted.
Okay.
It's in right now.
Thank you.
Being proposed.
Thank you so much. And in the interest of time, because other committee members have to go, are there any other comments or any questions that anyone has? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony.
Did you want Annie Carpenter?
Annie, did you? I'm sorry.
I could help the committee because I do the work on adopting regulations.
So I could.
If you have a question, I'm happy to try.
Reneg, did you want to answer the question that Senator Kukesh had?
If you would like me to, but I...
Okay, just if you just come up real quickly and answer that. I'm sorry, I didn't see you stand up until Senator Myers said. So for the record, just state your name and affiliation.
My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I work for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
And I love my job. I love the work that I do. But I probably my least favorite is every few years, I work for the fire marshal to adopt regulations, adopt the codes that we've been talking about. And I'll tell you what the process is from my point of view, which is the fire marshal sends to me these codes that they adopt by reference. And they, you know, they're this high. And you have to go through the codes because they accept from the adoption by reference various sections of the code that the fire marshal does not want to adopt by reference. I believe that the fire marshal would not be able to adopt any provision that deals with one and two resident buildings because that's not part of the statutory authority that is given to the fire marshal. They are not allowed to regulate buildings or residences under four units. So I just thought that might be helpful to you. And these are adopted by regulation, which are, you know, go through the regular regulatory process of public notice and hearings or comments made by people. And then they are adopted after consideration of those comments by various people. So that's the process that I go through every 4 years for the fire marshal. And they're the ones that are mainly responsible. But we go through these codes section by section. And you can see in this book that I have, for example, this includes the regulations adopted by the fire code, and it has, you know, they adopt the IBC with these exceptions, and they go on for pages and pages. And that's the process. And then you have the authority as legislators to change those if you don't like them, because that's you have the.
So we do have the authority. Okay, and I think there's a question.
That answered my question.
Okay, that's good. Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And I'm sorry, did I give you a chance?
That's fine.
Okay, good.
I think that's...
Okay, now I'm really going to close. Did you have something?
That's all right.
Okay, I'm going to close public testimony. Do any committee members have any further questions?
I have one.
Okay.
I went through this packet and I saw a lot of letters of support, but for some reason when we were here in testimony, I heard a lot of opposition. Did you not, in fact, get any letters in your office opposing this?
We did not. I just the fire. Go ahead, Michael. Quickly, please.
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Kukish. No, I was contacted only once by the AML and just had a brief conversation, and that was the end of that. And none of these people had ever contacted me.
And Senator, the only reason I bring it up is because I never expected to hear that much opposition on the online.
Mm-hmm.
And
from the firefighters.
To hear it and then not see anything in the record and in the letters, I was surprised. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what is the will of this committee?
Just as far as discussion, what I am trying to understand based upon what Annie Carpinetti indicated is that the state fire marshal cannot regulate a unit if it is under four units. Is that...
That's correct.
Assuming that is so, is there any need for this?
Well, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. And assuming that there were a need for this, I have a fundamental question as to why we shouldn't be allowing the local jurisdictions to fight the battles based upon the local jurisdictions' issues. Okay. But the extent that the state fire marshal can't even regulate under four units, I'm just wondering whether it's necessary.
Okay. Senator.
Just wanted to say that I'm a little uncomfortable with that also. I like the idea of having local options available whenever we have that ability to do that. And secondly, I really don't see the problem in Alaska yet. I really like to have something, I like to be in proactive, but I like to see a problem that we can correct at a legislative level. I just don't see it yet.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. So what is the will of the committee? Do you want to move this bill from State Affairs to the next committee of referral?
What is the next committee of referral?
Is it Resources or Debbie? What is the next committee?
Labor and Commerce.
Labor and Commerce.
Goes to you.
And then we could put amendments on there.
So Madam Chair, you want your bill to move the Labor and Commerce for
cleanup.
You want to do the cleanup work there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, out of respect to the chairman, then, since it's your bill, I'll move that we move Senate Bill number 129 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objections?
Yeah, I'll object just for comment.
Okay.
I really think this bill has some problems, and I hope that we can work on a labor and commerce. I really think that the local option has to be explored a little bit. I'd like some definition, some clarification on the whether this is really needed when we have the fire marshal definition of the four units. I'd like to have that discussed in the next committee referral. And I really still think that this is not a problem that's looming out there. And I think that I've always been opposed to legislation that just adds to the bureaucracy. So I guess I'm going to have to, I'll remove my objection, but I just wanted to make those comments.
Okay, then with that comment, appreciate that. Senate Bill 129 moves out of State Affairs to its next committee of referral, which is Labor and Commerce, which Senator Passban chairs. And we'll go ahead and sign for individual. We're going to take a short at ease after all that. To order, and now we have HJR 19 oil tanker escort vessels. And let's see, do all members have one of these pictures now at this time? Senator Kukesh, did you see this? Okay, thank you. Representative Osterman, are you in the audience? Okay, would you please come forward and state your name and affiliation? And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am not Representative Osterman, but I am his staff. Thank you for the opportunity to be here before you today.
You need to state your name, please.
My name is Erin Harrington, for the record. I've been trying to sort of figure out how to phrase this. Today is the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound. So it's not precisely an honor to be here, but it is sort of a solemn event and a moment for recognition. And I really appreciate you taking the opportunity to hear HJR 19 on this anniversary. There are many people around the state who are really keenly interested in this, and I think they really appreciate your efforts. And I know that we are short on time, so I'll just kind of quickly present to you this resolution. HJR 19 recognizes the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which is, of course, today. And it also supports the continued practice of accompanying each laden oil tanker in Prince William Sound with a two-vessel escort. A little bit of background. 20 years ago today, the Exxon Valdez oil spill ran aground on Bly Reef. It spilled nearly 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound. That oil spill oiled approximately 1,300 miles of Alaska coastline, not only in Prince William Sound, but also extending out from it and carried by tidal currents down throughout sections of the Gulf of Alaska, reaching as far away as Chignik, which is 700 miles away. Representative Osterman's district, which includes Kodiak and portions of the Lake and Peninsula area, is an oiled region of Alaska from the Prince William Sound oil spill. Estimated initial death toll related to the spill included 250,000 seabirds, 2,800 sea otters, 300 harbor seals, 250 bald eagles, up to 22 killer whales, billions of salmon and herring eggs that were in that Prince William Sound ecosystem and the ecosystems of the adjacent areas during that time, and many intertidal plants and animals, and many of the species that were impacted by the oil spill are still recovering today. Following the oil spill in 1990, the U.S. Congress passed the Oil Spill Prevention Act, which is referred to as OPA 90, and it addressed problems associated with preventing, responding to, and paying for oil pollution incidents in the U.S. There were a number of outcomes from OPA 90. One of the outcomes was that laden, oil-carrying tankers operating in Prince William Sound and other areas that had a single hull were required to be accompanied by a two-vessel escort. Mm-hmm. This is an a good outcome, but not a panacea. And the U.S. Coast Guard did an analysis following the Exxon Valdez oil spill, trying to consider what the reduction of that oil spill would have been had the Exxon Valdez been a double-hulled tanker. They found that it would have reduced the spill by 25% to 60%. So in the best-case scenario, where there were a 60% reduction, the Exxon Valdez spill would still have been a 4 million gallon spill, which still would have been catastrophic for the ecosystem and the surrounding areas. The state of Alaska also passed legislation following the Exxon Valdez oil spill to impact, to have a voice in the way that oil transportation was happening in the state. And under Alaska statute, the shippers now must have what are called oil spill prevention and contingency plans. And these plans, they work out with the Department of Environmental Conservation. And they do that every 5 years. They go through an exhaustive process where they look at the best methods for preventing and, in the worst case scenario, responding to an oil spill. These plans are not set in statute. They are developed through an iterative process with DEC. But under the current plan that's in effect for the Prince William Sound area, all of the laden tankers operating in Prince William Sound, single-hulled and double-hulled, do have a two-vessel escort throughout Prince William Sound. And there is a representative from DEC here if you have questions about more of the specifics of that. Okay. An important thing to note about these plans, though, is that although they are reviewed each 5 years, they also can be amended at the request of the shippers. So the shippers are able to come to DEC and work on amending those plans. It is a lengthy process, but they are not the provisions of the plan are not outlined in law anywhere. I provided you just a minute ago with a photo of what a typical tug escort might look like, and I just want to draw your attention to a couple things. You'll see the oil tanker proceeding in the front toward the top of the page. It's moving away from us. And then you'll see a two-tug escort. So one thing that you might notice is that the tug that's immediately behind the oil tanker is actually tethered to the ship. And that tethering is in place at certain places in Prince William Sound, and the idea is that if there were some sort of problem with that ship, that tug is immediately available to redirect its course, slow its path. These vessels can take up to 2 miles to stop, so you could see that it would be pretty critical to be able to respond quickly to some sort of incident. Then you'll see a second vessel following that, and you'll notice that that vessel has little boats on it, little cranes.
Okay, I'm sorry, we have a question here. Senator Kukesh.
I was just wondering, I know this is only a resolution, we're spending probably a lot more time on it. We should, but my question is there a chance that this two, the Oil Pollution Act is going to, of 1990 is going to be amended and we're going to eliminate the two tugs? Or what is the purpose of this resolution, which is, by the way, is only a resolution?
Senator Kukesh, through the chair. Open 90, the requirements for a two-tug escort are only applied to single-hulled tugs, or excuse me, single-hulled tankers. And the last of the single-hulled tankers is will be gone from Prince William Sound by 2012 at the latest, and likely within the next 1 to 2 years. So with the passage of the last single-hulled tanker from Prince William Sound, there's no longer any federal requirement that calls for any two-tug escorts in Prince William Sound. There, you may have read, and I provided for you this morning, their editorials in the Anchorage Daily News, the Fairbanks News Miner, and then also there's a lot of reporting going on this right now. And Congressman Young was on the radio this morning. Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski have both spoken to this issue. There is interest in potentially pursuing at the national level legislation that would continue to require a two-tug escort, regardless of whether a vessel were single or double-hulled. But with the passage of the last single-hulled tanker,
he has a follow-up.
Well,
Senator,
for the purposes and try to get to the point here,
sure.
The resolution is asking the state legislature to send a message to Congress to continue the two-tug escort. That's basically all we're trying to do here.
That's
today,
correct.
Right?
It is.
Okay. Just in the interest of time, and we've had opportunities here, I think, to study up on this, but any other senators have any question of the presentation? Okay, thank you very much, sure. And you'll be available, I'm sure, for further questions. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Now we have some public testimony from Dorothy Moore of Valdez. Dorothy, could you keep your state your name and affiliation and keep your testimony to 1 minute, please?
Thank you, Senator Menard. I will try to. My name is Dorothy Moore. I am a lifelong resident of Valdez and a former Alaska history teacher. Currently, I'm an elected member of the Valdez City Council and represent the and their representative to the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council.
Okay.
I urge your support of HJR 19. We have 20 years of experience that work. I don't think we need to fix something that isn't broken. And I think we need to learn from the past to protect Prince William Sound for all of Alaska. We have 20 years of experience that work.
Thank you for the testimony, Dorothy, and for keeping it short. We appreciate that. Okay, next we have Larry Dietrich from Juneau, Department of Environmental Conservation.
Madam Chair, I'm available for any questions to the department.
Thank you very much. Tom Kluckertjes, I'm not pronouncing that. Could you pronounce it, please, and state your affiliation, please?
Hi, my name is Tom Kuckertz, and I believe you've all been briefed on the, and I work for the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council in Valdez, and I believe you've been briefed by Senator Osterman's staff on a lot of the technical details, so I'll just go over it very quickly. Basically, RCAC has 18 member entities, and the mission of RCAC is citizens promoting the environmentally safe transportation of oil and the Alyeska tanker and the Alyeska terminal and the associated tankers. And basically, we're here doing our mission. We're promoting the environmentally safe transportation of oil. We have a system in place that has done very well over the last 20 years. We think that two tugs are very important with respect to this transportation of oil, and we urge your support, we request your support of this particular resolution.
Thank you, Tom, and I'll ask you the same questions I asked you at 8:15 in my office this morning. Is anyone opposing the bill? Of course, we heard the Coast Guard, and just speak to that for just a quick minute, please.
We do not know of any opposition, but folks have said that, you know, for example, the Coast Guard, you know, is interested in doing a risk assessment with respect to, you know, determining whether or not two tugs are required. We believe that risk assessments are not needed in this case. It may not be a reasonable thing to do. The main reason is that the risk assessments tend to be biased towards those who are paying for them, but it can be worse than that. In essence, the risk is basically you multiply what the probability of something happening is times the consequences. A very small number by a very large number. Typically, the if you want to look at the small number, that's the there's been 15,000 tanker trips. There's been one big accident. So the probability of such an accident happening, as observed, is 1 in 15,000. The folks that want to do a risk assessment will tell you that we don't want to use that number because it's too large. You know, we want to use 1 in a million. Well, we know it's not 1 in a million.
Right, yeah.
So the
thank
risk
you, and I did misspeak. It's a resolution, so.
Yes.
Okay, is there any other senators? Okay, Senator Kukesh.
A lot of money has been spent since the Exxon Valdez spill to build double-hull tankers. What was the purpose of building double-hull tankers if we are going to continue to use two tugs? And my second part of that question is, who pays for the second tug? Is it the industry? Is it the... I need to know, I'd like to know, and I'd like to see whether they support the two-tug system. I'm all for safety, but I'm really thinking that we've maybe crossed that threshold a little bit ways back by saying everybody's required now to build double-hull tankers. I'm sure that's a huge expense to somebody.
Yes, Madam Chair, the second tug, in fact, both tugs are paid for by industry. And there always has been at least a single tug escort, which would, and this is a system that's worked well over the years. With respect to double hull tankers, double hulls, and we could get into a fairly long discussion with respect to the merits and the you know, deficiencies of double hulls. They do improve the release of oil when you have a low energy grounding. For example, if you sideswipe a bridge, such as happened in the Costco Busan, chances are a double hull would not have leaked. In the case of a high energy grounding, such as the Exxon Valdez, there's a fair number of models, and they say, well, it could be reduced at 60% or 40%, but we haven't really done the experiment. The Exxon Valdez had half its bottom ripped out. And it's not certain that a double hull would have been that much better than the Exxon Valdez did in that type of accident. Another issue with double hulls is that they tend to ride higher in the water. And that means that if you rip a hole in the inner hull there, the oil is under gravitational forces to force it out more so than it would be if it was a single hull. So there, and we can go on with the list of problems that double hulls have. I would hope that the question has been answered.
Okay, has that been adequate?
No.
No. Okay. Okay. All right. Senator Pasvan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume that we're doing it by resolution rather than law because of federal preemption under the Commerce Clause. Is that?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm an engineer. So I believe that that's the case, but I do not have the legal background to answer that question in any reasonable fashion. But indeed, we have requested the resolution because we believe that it will assist us and the state of Alaska in making sure that our resources are protected should federal legislation be necessary to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. And now we'll have John Valsco. Could you come forward, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is John Velsko, and I represent the City of Homer on the Prince William Sound RCAC, and I wanted to speak in favor of House Resolution 19. I think we need to make clear that this is not a resolution against the oil industry. I've lived in Homer for 35 years, and I've seen how oil tax dollars have built our infrastructure. So. We need that industry in Alaska. As a young man, I worked on construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The oil industry contributes a lot of money and wages for thousands of Alaskans, so I want to make clear it's not against the oil companies. However, having said that, I also fish for salmon and halibut commercially. My youngest son is a full-time professional commercial fisherman. He supports his family through fishing income. So the oil industry has to share Alaskan waters with other users. And if we can pass this resolution, it will be the first step in codifying in law or regulation the continuation of the practice of using two tugs in Prince William Sound.
Thank you, John.
Thanks.
Okay. Are you like this? Like, yes, you have a question? Are you
no.
Good? Okay. Next, then, is Jerry McClune. He is the last person to testify. Please come up and state your name and try to keep it under a minute, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry McClune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska, and I'm president of Cordova District Fishermen United. I'll make it real brief. We support the resolution, and we've learned over 20 years that prevention is the key, and most people from westward all the way down to southeast would not argue with me that two escorts are makes everybody have some peace of mind that those tankers can be towed or pushed or moved or whatever could happen, maybe prevent the human error factor also. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other senators that have questions?
I have a question.
Okay, Senator Kukesh.
How would we find out what the additional cost of that second tug would be? I mean, I don't even know if we know what the cost of one tug is, but I'd like to hear from somebody. Do you know what the industry's position is on this second tug?
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, I think they're in the audience. I don't know if I can speak for the oil industry, but I think on the resolution that they're neutral in right now. And I don't know the cost. I think the Alaska probably, I could probably get that cost for you what those are.
I'd just like to know as well.
Can't be cheap with that price of fuel.
I'm sure it isn't.
Maybe we can get that information to Senator Kukesh. Okay, I'm going to close public testimony. Do senators have any questions or comments? Okay. If the committee is ready to move this bill out of state affairs, the next committee of referral was resource, and that got pulled, so it'll probably go to the floor or rules. Do I hear a motion to move this out of committee?
I would move
Senator
that we pass House Joint Resolution 19 from this committee to the next committee or the floor, whatever is appropriate with the individual recommendations, and attach fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, House Joint Resolution 19 moves from State Affairs to its next, could be rules or the floor, with fiscal note attached. Okay, and then we're going to take a brief at ease to sign. State Affairs back, and I'm not sure how far we'll get. We have a lot of commitments here coming up, but I'm trying to move it. This is Senate Bill 126, Reemployment of Retirees, Exempt Service. Let's see, is Ginger here? Okay, Director of Administration Service, the Department of Revenue is here to present Senate Bill 126. Ginger, will you come forward, give your testimony, please? State your name for the record.
All right, for the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. And this bill has three parts to it. One of them affects the Department of Revenue. It's two positions. There are approximately 23 positions affected for the Department of Natural Resources, and then the extension of the sunset for the retire rehiree program. And what I had planned to do was just read the sponsor statement into the record and then open it up for questions for each department.
The sponsor statement is quite lengthy. Can you sum it up on each?
I can sum it up in a couple of sentences for each group.
That'd be great, if that's okay. If that's in agreement with the other members.
Okay. The two departments the two positions for the Department of Revenue, one is a state comptroller and one is a chief economist. The chief economist is currently a classified position in the supervisory bargaining unit. We have not been able to fill this position after multiple recruitments. It's been vacant for getting close to a year and a half now, and so we're looking to exempt it so that we can hire outside of the standard pay scale. The second position is our state comptroller. That position has turned over four times in the same 4 years. Each time the person has left for a higher paying job, doing the same work, higher pay elsewhere, which is also why we're looking at having that moved into the exempt service instead of partially exempt, so that we could use a different pay scale. The 23 positions in the Department of Natural Resources are also professional level positions, which they're just outmarketed. Market-based pay in the private sector is significantly higher than what the state can offer on a normal pay scale. So we're looking at taking them from temporary project service into full-time exempt status for a long-term project. And then the retire rehire provision is a program that has gone, I think it's had two different terms that we've had a retire rehire program for the state of Alaska. This one is scheduled to sunset on June 30th, which means that July 1st, the few employees that are retirees would have to make a choice whether they retain their current position and stop receiving retirement benefits or retire. And then that position would become vacant. And that's the quick version of the bill.
So the first rehired program started in 2001 and then a second time in 2005. And what was the original intent of that?
Well, the original intent was to fill positions that were difficult to fill. We did have an employee or a a labor pool shortage, and that was the original intent.
So prior to 2001, were retired PERS and TERS members prohibited to returning to work for the state in any capacity?
Once you retired, you would receive retirement benefits. If you returned to a same retirement plan job, so if you retired from PERS and went back to PERS, you would forfeit your retirement pay and you would just receive your regular position pay.
So this bill would exempt that, and there'd be 23 employees that currently you feel would be affected.
The 23 employees
are DNR.
At DNR, mm-hmm. And they are not retire-rehire. The retire-rehire is in, the actual employees are listed in this Alaska legislative report that each of you have in your packet. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that right now we have 77 TERS active retirees, mm-hmm. And so that's the teacher retirement system, and there are 47 PERS active retirees. 36 of those PERS employees are state employees, mm-hmm. The other 11 are local government employees that also use the PERS retirement system.
And I guess just as a follow-up, how does this legislation affect young people or employees that want to climb up the ladder?
With regard to the retire-rehire.
Right.
There have been a number of questions on upward mobility, and the basic response to that is that the retire-rehire program only allows a retiree to be considered for a position if there are fewer than five candidates for any given position. If there are fewer than five candidates and a retiree wants to be considered, they are considered along with the other candidates. It is not a shoo-in that they get that job. Mm-hmm. As far as upward mobility, I think that there are so few positions when you look at just the state of Alaska has approximately 15,000 to 17,000 employees depending on the season. Mm-hmm. And so having only 36 positions that utilize this program is a quite small percentage. So
compared to other states, or
I can't speak on the behalf of other states.
Okay.
Yeah, someone from the Department of Administration.
I guess where I'm coming from, I've always had a fundamental problem with people retire out and then mm-hmm. others are, finally I'll get a chance, and then they come back in and then they're taking the slots of others who certainly maybe their first year out of the docket they're not as good, but they certainly have potential. And I just see, just like I said, a fundamental thing that really has always gone through my grade. These people come back into the system again, mm-hmm. and it shuts out opportunities. And that's why I it's just a question I've always had to struggle with and have seen it over the years in state government. Mm-hmm. Senator Passavant.
So if I understand what you're saying, there's 124 TERS and PERS now, and you want to expand that with an additional 23 positions in DNR?
No, there are two separate actions that are happening under this particular piece of legislation. The two positions in revenue and the 23 positions in DNR are currently either exempt or classified, and we just want to be able to consider them in the exempt service so that we can use a different pay scale. The retire-rehire program is a separate provision. It does not involve any of those 25 positions that we're looking to exempt.
And do you know what the average retirement is of those 124 people?
I don't know what the average retirement is for those folks. Yeah, I'd have to have someone from the Department of Administration.
I'm going to let Senator French ask a question, but had you ever thought of, like, dividing the question, like they'd say, and treating it separately as two separate bills, the exempt and the other?
Yeah, it certainly has two different kinds of topics.
Components.
It all falls under personnel-related issues. I'm not sure why the governor chose to keep it in one bill.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Okay, Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. is this must-have legislation? What happens if we don't pass this?
If you do not pass the portion that allows positions to become exempt, basically those positions would either remain in the non-perm or temporary status with the Department of Natural Resources. And for the Department of Revenue, our two positions, one of them has been vacant for more than a year now, and the other one, we're hoping our comptroller won't leave us again. So is it critical? It's critical to the needs of the state of Alaska, but not critical if the legislation doesn't pass. We would just hope that those people will keep those jobs and stay with us. The retire-rehire provision does sunset on June 30th. And so July 1st, you would have 124 people making a choice on whether they were going to retain in their position or leave their position, and it would then be open for recruitment. So,
and just as a follow-up, if they retained in their position, they would stop getting their PERS retirement or their TERS retirement. Would that be the effect?
That's correct. They would just be receiving their regular pay.
So I guess I'll ask it again from the governor's perspective. Is this must-have legislation?
You know, I'm the carrier of the bill, and the Department of Administration would have to speak to that part. I have not checked with the governor's office on that. And they were here waiting. We anticipated introducing the bill, and then you needed to end the hearing.
Yeah,
so
sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, so they aren't here right now to speak to us.
Madam Chair, I don't want to prolong things, but I have many questions about this, and I know we're running short on time, so I hope we're not rushing through to pass the bill out of committee today. We're just trying to get it on the record so we can address it in a future hearing.
And thank you for pointing that out to me, because I tend to want to do that. So
that's okay. I'm just letting you know, at least know where one of your committee members is.
And I think in the interest of time, if it's agreeable to the other committee members, maybe we will take this up on Thursday again, because there'll be a couple other committee members available here too, and it is a very important, and it's so with that, I'm going to, if there's no objections, call this state affairs meeting over. Thank you very much for your testimony.